Let's head off to the Northern Territory. Well, there was great excitement and a lot of hype in Arnhem Land last weekend. A sounding rocket was launched on a suborbital flight. Russell Shaw of Equatorial Launch Australia explains why.
The NASA space launches are a series of scientific launches for the universities of Colorado and Wisconsin in the US. And we'll be focusing on some astrophysics studies into Alpha Centauri A and B and the X-rays coming from the interstellar space.
The payload on a rocket is the instrument being carried as distinct from the mass of the rocket and its fuel.
This rocket is a 22-meter rocket that's carrying about a 2-ton total carry payload. And this includes the primary mission, which is a X-ray quantum calimeter. So this is measuring X-ray light from the Milky Way galaxy, led by Dan McCannon out of the University of Wisconsin.
And launch commentator Brad Tucker spoke with one of the scientists involved. Now listen closely, because after this we will get into "it ain't necessarily so" territory.
Hi, I'm Kevin France from the University of Colorado. I'm NASA's campaign scientist for the ELA launches. I'm also the principal investigator of the Sistine mission, which is going to launch on July 4th. I've been working on this project for about 10 years, trying to find a way to bring our telescopes to the southern hemisphere to observe Alpha Centauri. I'm just extremely excited to be here at this beautiful new launch site, be able to launch on the 4th and see this exciting ultraviolet data of Alpha Centauri A and B.
Kevin is the campaign scientist, right?
That's right.
And the second mission, though, is a tad closer to your heart?
That's right, yeah. I'm also the principal investigator for the second mission, the Sistine flight that's going to go on July 4th.
Now, what is Sistine going to do?
So Sistine is an ultraviolet spectrograph that's going to study Alpha Centauri, a very beautiful southern hemisphere sky, bright star. And we're going to study the ultraviolet radiation from that star to understand how habitable planets may exist around that star.
So, yeah, so Alpha Centauri is that star near the Southern Cross that
That's right.
We love to look at. And so how many planets do we know of around Alpha Centauri?
So there's a debatable planet around Alpha Centauri today, but it's a huge target for finding and searching for Earth-like planets around solar-like stars. So Alpha Centauri is actually a spectacular twin of the Sun. And so being the nearest Sun-like star, it's the focus of a lot of our efforts to find Earth-like planets.
But it's the closest we get, really.
That's right.
Besides our Sun.
That's right. It's our best shot to find another, you know, Earth 2.0.
So when you say ultraviolet, so what do people mean? So in Australia, we're very used to being sunburnt during the summer. So is this the sort of same ultraviolet light that you're looking at?
It's actually even more ultraviolet. You know, it's all part of the larger electromagnetic spectrum, but the rays that we're worried about at the beach are, we call them in wavelengths, 300 nanometers. Yep. We're about three times shorter wavelengths than that, down to about 100 nanometers.
And so that means you're also probing hotter of the star in the system.
That's right. It's also why we have to put it on a rocket, because we have to get above Earth's atmosphere, which is, the protective layer is great for us when we're at the beach, but rough if you're trying to study the light.
So that's the only way, right? So you have to put this on a rocket up there to see it, and because the target is in the southern hemisphere, you need to launch
From the south. That's right. That's why we've been asking NASA to do this for 10 years, because there are these beautiful targets in the southern hemisphere we just can't observe from our normal launch sites.
Now, you have a little bit to do also with the third mission, part of your broader team?
That's right. So the third mission is also coming from the University of Colorado, and I developed the science case for that mission as well. It's all part of our larger team that works together, and it's observing even farther ultraviolet light, what we call extreme ultraviolet light, which goes down to about 55 nanometers, which is really, really short wavelengths,
And is it also going to be looking at Alpha Centauri as well?
That's right. It's studying Alpha Centauri. The idea was that the Sistine and the Deuce missions, Launch 2 and Launch 3, would be like a joint science project. And they would just cover different parts of the spectrum because we don't have one instrument that can do everything.
That's right, because the technologies actually has to be very different
from looking specific
in those.
That's right.
So were these missions or telescopes built specifically for this, or have it been flown previously?
So Sistine was developed, the Launch 2 was developed for this exact science case. In fact, it was designed for this star about 7 or 8 years ago. The other mission, Launch 3 Deuce, it was also designed to study very massive stars. Very bright blue stars. And it's launched three times already to study blue stars, but we kind of, you know, tweaked it a little bit and repurposed it for this science case.
Now, what are you hoping the data will show? Because I think this is one of the exciting things is I think people think, hey, telescope goes up and you have pretty pictures on your computer screen. Not exactly what happens.
This is the less beautiful side of astronomy. This is spectroscopy. And so, you know, this is basically we take a spectrum of the star's light and we analyze where the bumps and wiggles in this wiggly line. But there's so much information there because from a spectrum we can understand how hot something is, what it's made of, you know, what its motions of the gas are.
Yeah, some of its age.
Its age, exactly. All these things we can't get from a picture alone. So so we're building these into kind of a catalog of these ultraviolet spectra that we're going to use to understand which are the best star-planet systems to search for life.
And so how long does it actually take to get that data back?
It happens in real time. It comes down on the telemetry link that's on board the rocket. So we see it in real time. In fact, we use the real time to video to decide how to point the rocket during the flight.
Yeah, so Scott was talking about this, that you slightly have to adjust the rocket to align on the target, and so that's how you kind of where to align.
It's like the world's most expensive video game. And we have our students. This is always a historical way that we do things in the project, is that we put the student right in the deep end, and they're the ones that are actually seeing the real-time display and are driving the rocket in real time to make the observation.
So they either get their PhD or they don't.
Or there's a tremendous amount of international resources wasted.
So when you're doing this adjustment, once the rocket is launched and you're essentially starting to get into suborbital space, you guys then take over all of that pointing and stuff like that,
That's right. It happens at about 100 seconds after launch.
Okay.
The attitude control system, so we go up with the pointy end up.
Yeah.
And then our telescope looks out the back. So it flips over during the flight.
Okay. Yep.
There's a door that opens and our telescope points towards the target, and then we can start steering in to bring the target into the aperture.
And then do you have any control of it coming back down, or essentially it gets there, you're done, and...
So yeah, all we can do is control the pointing during the flight. We can also turn on and off the instrument if something were wrong. But knock on wood, we've never had to do that.
It'll be fine this time, don't worry.
But the rest of it all happens on timers. So at about 450 seconds after the observations start, the power will turn off, the door will close, and the whole payload starts to spin as it re-enters the atmosphere, and it spins to distribute the heat so it doesn't melt part of the rocket as it comes in.
So on the long side of the rocket, essentially, right?
That's right, yeah.
And so then you go out then the day after and recover your instrument?
That's right. So there's a helicopter that's on site, and we pick up everything for this launch. We pick up, it's a two-stage motor, so we pick up the booster motor and the sustainer motor. And we also go first to go get the science payload because it has the most sort of, it doesn't like to be sitting outside.
Well, look, so the second launch is scheduled for the 4th of July?
4th of July.
And then the third launch is the 12th of July,
That's
correct?
That's right, yep.
And those windows are, there's still a few launch windows for each of those?
That's right. I think each has 3 days that we can do. I think the conditions here have been really very nice, I say now. I'm pretty optimistic that we'll be able to launch on the original dates planned. But we've got a three-day backup in case.
And so after a delay to allow an unseasonable rainstorm to pass, this happened.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
And off into the night sky it went. Now, if you have ever read the crocodile stories in the Northern Territory newspapers, you will not believe every report about this launch from the Northern Territory. First, super excited Northern Territory Chief Minister Natasha Files.
The Northern Territory certainly will be the focus of not only Australia but the world. The Northern Territory certainly will be the focus of not only Australia but the world.
Really? There are up to a dozen such rockets fired each month. So why should the world sit up and take notice of this one? In the words of Scott, the NASA operations manager for these Australian launches.
And so how often do you actually are launching sounding rockets? Obviously, right. First time for a long time in Australia,
That's
but for
right.
the U.S.
So in the U.S., so our program travels around the world. So we do launch from Wallops, which is NASA's only owned and operated launch range. But we also launch out of Norway, yep. out of Svalbard, Poker Flats, Alaska, White Sands, New Mexico, the Marshall Islands, yep. and now Australia. But our program sort of built around 18 to 22 missions a year.
Okay.
In fact, we actually launched a mission from Wallops this morning at 5:30 in the morning for a student mission back home.
Okay, and then you're getting ready for...
Less than 48 hours later, hopefully we'll have one launch from Australia.
And so is there a view that by having multiple sites that potentially there is that growth of having more of this program available to these experiments?
Absolutely. I mean, so the 18 to 22 are sort of, you know, spread out, and we just go to where the scientists want to
yeah.
go. So, you know, wherever the grants come in, we're happy to go. But there is a lot of interest. You know, it's been, like I said, over two decades since we've launched in the Southern Hemisphere.
In Darwin, Channel 9's Amy Clement clearly had not prepared for this reporting assignment.
Amy Clements is following this story for us. Amy, when is liftoff?
Morning, Jane. Well, NASA plans to launch its rocket around 11 o'clock this evening from the middle of the Australian outback at the Arnhem Space Centre near Nhulunbuy. It's the first of three NASA rockets set to be launched, and its mission includes collecting space junk and also learning more about the Southern Hemisphere.
What? Collecting space junk? Now, did you hear scientist Kevin France mention space junk in that report I played earlier? And her mention of the Southern Hemisphere was unclear, if not downright misleading. Now, Michael Jones is CEO and Executive Chairman of Equatorial Launch Australia. I have no reason to expect that he is not excellent in that role, but he clearly had no grasp on the purpose of these flights. This from Sky News.
Yeah, so there are three different missions we're doing. The first one that just went last night is using an X-ray telescope that comes out of the body of the rocket, and it was looking at atmospheric and galactic sort of phenomena surrounding some of our nearest stars. And they're looking at using an X-ray telescope. So they were looking at Alpha Centauri and its subset stars of Alpha and Bravo, which are 430 million light years away. So they're a long way away. And so they need this very specialized equipment, which we cryogenically cooled with liquid helium. It gets to a point of, you know, about minus 270 degrees. And that allows it in the dark, in the Southern Hemisphere, because some of these phenomena can only be seen from the Southern Hemisphere.
Wow, Alpha Centauri has moved. No wonder NASA wants to study it. And this wasn't just a slip of Michael's tongue. This on Channel 9.
The reason for the launches, all three of them are scientific missions. They're looking at astrophysical phenomena in the sky. They're night launches because they don't want the effect of the sun to block out the observation instruments that they're using, and there are three different sorts of instruments, and please don't ask me to explain them. They're incredibly complex. But basically the first one tonight is cryogenically cooled by liquid helium, is run very, very cold, almost at absolute zero. It's launched into space. It'll go about 300 kilometres into space, and it'll be doing, as I said, astrophysical observation out into a number of targets, and one of them is the star cluster of Alpha Centauri, the closest star to Australia, which is about 430 million light years away, so not close, but they're taking those observations. They'll do that for a number of minutes beaming data back to us here in Arnhem Land.
Well, last time I checked, Alpha Centauri was 4.367 light years away, no matter where you are on Earth. Okay, well, launch commentator for this broadcast was Australian National University scientist Brad Tucker. Now, in his enthusiasm, he made this slip of the tongue.
This is the main star of the show, so to speak. The scientists may disagree whose payloads are on it. Now, this is a Black Bright 9 rocket. So this is the thing that's going to be launching later tonight.
So, of course, he meant Black Brant 9, not Black Bright 9. So it's a Black Brant 9 rocket, which, by the way, I never heard mentioned on any of the news reports about this launch. Now, on the ABC, one reporter said quite convincingly that the rocket had gone into orbit. Now, that just had to be correct. We believe everything we hear on the ABC, don't we? Well, this was no more orbital than a child's ball thrown upwards. Also on the ABC was Kathleen Lively, the United States Consul General.
The launch that ended up putting people on the moon in 1969 is where we first started working with Australia in space, and that relationship has continued ever since then. And so this is just one more step, in that journey.
Now, NASA involvement goes way back before the glory days of Apollo. For example, from 1960, there was a large space tracking antenna at Island Lagoon near Woomera in South Australia. So, even if you saw it on television, just remember that.
Take NASA.